You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Salman Rushdie was awarded a Booker Prize in 1993 for his novel Midnight's Children, and then the Booker of the Bookers, which declared Midnight's Children the best of 25 years of Booker Prize winners. Now critics are talking about yet another Booker for his latest novel, The Enchantress of Florence. It's published by Random House, and it is with great pleasure that I welcome Salman Rushdie back to this program. Hi.
Hi, nice to be back.
Didn't Queen Elizabeth knight you a year ago? Do I have to call you Sir Salman?
You can if you want, but it'd be just as easy to drop it.
Would you say that one of your major themes over the years has been the culture clash between East and West?
Yeah, not just the clash, but also the fruitful and creative and enriching engagement between East and West.
One of your epigraphs for your last novel, Shalimar the Clown, was Mercutio's famous line from Romeo and Juliet, "A plague on both your houses." In this book, you say, "We are their dream and they are ours." So is this the other side of the coin, or are you just softening in old age?
Maybe that, but I think and nothing wrong with that either, by the way. but what I found is I started out writing a book which I thought would be about two worlds, both at a kind of pinnacle of their culture, you know, the High Renaissance in Europe, the peak of the Mughal Empire in India, two glorious moments in both worlds, but very disconnected, you know, very little contact between them 400 years ago. And I thought if I could just find a story that brings them together, how interesting those differences would be, you know. And then what I found in researching it and writing it was that actually what they had in common was much more involving and engaging and much larger than what they had that divided them, you know. So having started out writing a novel about difference, I thought, I ended up writing a novel about similarity.
But the Medicis didn't have anything like the kind of power that Akbar the Great has.
No, not in terms of power, but in terms of meditations about power, the kinds of thinking going on about humanism versus brutal realpolitik, you know, were very similar in the two worlds. They were both cultures having a great artistic moment. They were both very hedonistic cultures, very sexual, highly sensualized cultures, a world full of courtesans and promiscuity. So in all and both of them, I think that in a way, the thing that in the end united the novel for me, worlds which profoundly believed in magic, you know, more than they believed in Christianity or Islam. They believed in the everyday influence of magic in their lives.
Although Akbar the Great, actually Akbar the Great means the great, doesn't
yes,
it?
Yes, it's a tautology, but it seemed to be a necessary tautology to represent his greatness, I suggest, in the book, you know.
Well, what did they think at the time? Were people aware of the fact that they were calling him, well, they would call him Akbar al-Akbar?
No, it was a nickname. I mean, wasn't his real name, but when he was a kid, he started being called Akbar. And then when he became the so-called Grand Mughal, he wasn't really called Akbar the Great by his contemporaries, actually. What he was mostly called was the Shelter of the World. That was the Jahanpanah, which means the Shelter of the World.
Only Peter was called Peter the Great. Yeah. Catherine was, I guess the Russians could be the Greats.
Yes.
But it's interesting that this man who is enlightened to some degree, who thinks about the sorts of things that we also associate with the Renaissance in the West, would go through a debate with himself as to whether to refer to himself in the first or third person.
Yeah, I mean,
and he opts for the third
he
person.
He opts for the third because he is a king. You know, the thing to remember about Akbar is often held up in India as a model of tolerance and inclusiveness, and you know, political and philosophical modernity, if you like, you know. And that's all, it's true, but it's also true that he was an absolute monarch. I mean, he was
in a way that the West has never understood.
Never seen, a true despot where everybody in the world was at his mercy. And he was not interested in not being a despot, you know. He wasn't some kind of democrat with a crown, you know. I mean, he was a magnificent and overwhelmingly autocratic ruler who also happened to be a very tolerant and open-minded man.
We've seen this with some of the Chinese emperors as well, philosopher kings who, on the one hand, think about beauty and human relations, on the other hand, don't want to give up one bit of power.
See, the thing that's interesting to me about Akbar is that if you look behind Akbar, if you look at the generations immediately past him, behind him, they're very brutal. They're bathed in blood, you know. And he's the descendant of Genghis Khan and Tamerlane and so on. So behind him, there's this world of violence. And yet he is beginning to look forward to another kind of world. And it's that sort of threshold figure that he is that makes him so interesting.
Well, he even questions the truth of religion.
He did.
In your novel. Is that based on fact?
It's sort of true. He was very... he had a great problem with the religions as they were constructed, you know, and even some of his contemporaries quietly whispered that he wasn't religious enough, and that, in fact, one or two of them even suggested he might have turned away from God, which I don't think he did.
Well, he's the Mughal emperor in India, a country which had a majority Hindu population. Mm-hmm. So how did he work that out for himself?
Well, that's the great change, you see, that in his... I mean, he was a great military leader. He defeated most of his immediate rivals, you know, in terms of smaller princes and so on, ruling areas of North India. But unlike his predecessors who would have executed them, his response tended to be to give them a job in his government and marry their daughter.
Also interesting, thinking of the future relationship of India with England, he writes letters to Queen Elizabeth.
Yes, I made that up.
I'm not surprised. Well, you to some degree, this book is really about you, isn't it? I mean, you were born in India, a Muslim in India, and then you go to public school, what is private school, public school in England, and you're both an outsider and an insider in both cultures.
Well, it's true to say my life has been defined by journeys, you know, journeys, transcultural journeys. And this is a novel about a journey between cultures. So in that sense, yes. But the thing that actually interested me about writing it was, first of all, I think, you know, I managed to find what I thought of as a great yarn, this kind of 16th century shaggy dog story about a Mughal princess ending up in Renaissance Italy and creating havoc, and maybe she's
the most
witch.
Beautiful woman in the world.
Yeah, well, amongst other things, yeah, but also a witch.
The Enchantress of Florence.
And the interesting thing, one of the interesting things is that in this period, the idea of female beauty, the idea of erotic power, was very often linked to occult power, that women were believed to be often capable of more than simply sexual enchantment, but actually literal enchantment. And so that became an idea that I tried to develop and play with. But, you know, in many ways, the great difference, the great pleasure of writing the book was that the way people thought then is not the way we think now. So actually, the pleasure of going back into another, not just another world, but another way of seeing the world, you know, a much more fantastic way, a way in which, as I say, the miraculous and the everyday coexisted.
So you include 5 pages of bibliography.
Yeah, I did.
And this is obviously based on history, and yet there is this magical realism element.
Well,
but
of course,
people see this as something that is modern or postmodern, when in fact you're suggesting it also has its roots in another time.
Well, the great thing about the past is that it is true that the best stuff is stuff you couldn't make up. I mean, there was stuff that I stumbled on that I wouldn't have dared to make up. You know, for instance, there's a moment when the enchantress, the Mughal princess, is moving across the world. At this particular moment in the story, she's involved in a battle between the Persian Empire and the Ottoman Turkish Empire. And in doing the reading for this, I suddenly discovered, to my enormous joy, that the Ottomans at this point had been fighting a campaign against Dracula. You know, at the moment at which I realized I could have Dracula in my novel, you know, I kind of thought I'd died and gone to heaven, and this stuff just fell in my lap.
But it's also a suggestion that we will never totally be able to work out our cultural differences, especially in the light of the current tensions between the West and much of the Islamic world.
Yeah, but I mean, I think, but this is the two great, I think, defining ways of looking at human relations is the things that bring us together and the things that drive us apart. And they're always there. I mean, one of the things that I think is interesting, a lot of people have asked me whether this novel is really about now. And I said, you know, I wasn't trying to do that, but the thing that is constant is human nature. You know, if we were brutal then, we're brutal now. You know, if we were treacherous then, we're treacherous now.
And how can you write about the past without bringing to it all your knowledge of everything
yeah.
that is
After all,
followed?
I'm writing from the present. You know, so it is, in that sense, of course it's about the present, but I don't like those books which underline that too much. And I'd rather let the reader find echoes that satisfy them.
My guest is Salman Rushdie, whose latest book is The Enchantress of Florence, which is published by Random House. And everybody's remarked on Scheherazade aspect mm-hmm. of this book, but I was thinking, what about the Decameron as well? We're talking about Florence, and we're talking about the Mughal. We're talking about the center of Islamic culture at this time. They're both books in which people tell wondrous stories.
Yeah, no, I mean the Decameron certainly was part of the inspiring reading that I did in the background for the book. They were days in which people told tales of wonder, in which the idea that stories must only be naturalistic had not occurred to anyone. You know, that people fully expected that stories would contain, you know, winged horses, flying carpets, you know, powerful potions, all kinds of elements which were not of the everyday. But that is a wonderful liberation for a writer to feel that you're in part in that imaginative context.
Now, your storyteller's name is Niccolo Vespucci. Mm. You've given him the same last name as the explorer that America's named after.
Yeah, and in fact, well, the Vespucci family was a big family in Florence at this time, and I'm suggesting that he is a kind of distant relative of. And there is a point late in the novel when the New World, as it was then beginning to be called, just heaves into view on the horizon in the kind of last moment of the books. That's one of the extraordinary things about this moment, that people's worldview is being changed by the discovery that the world is not the shape they thought it was. You know, and imagine what that would do to you if suddenly you were told that the world is twice the size you think it is, and that there's a whole gigantic area that you never knew existed, which actually is there. And the kind of change that makes in the way in which you see everything, you know, this was a moment of a great radical change of that nature.
So it wasn't just East meeting West, it was a realization that it was another place altogether.
A whole other thing. And actually, one of the things that, I mean, Amerigo Vespucci gets kind of a bad press. People say that he made up a lot of his discoveries and so on. But I think, and there's truth in that, but the thing that he did do, which Columbus never did, was to realize that this was a new world. You know, Columbus always thought he'd found the Indies, you know, lived and died thinking it. But Vespucci was the one who started saying, look, guys, this is not the Indies. This is a whole new thing, and we have to look at the world quite differently.
Your Vespucci also has ties to Niccolo Machiavelli.
Yeah. Well, I've always loved Machiavelli ever since I studied history at college, and I always felt he got a very bad deal from history because, you know, Machiavelli wasn't Machiavellian. I mean, if he had his tragedy, I think, was to see the world too clearly, you know, to see power as it really operated in that world of the Medicis and the Borgias, you know, the very brutal power politics, and to say it. And then it's a great case of shooting the messenger.
It's like Marx describing capitalism.
Yes.
Machiavelli described the way statecraft was conducted during his lifetime.
And the way it really was, without any kind of disguise or flattery or embellishment, just the basic, bald operation of power. And for that, he gets blamed for making it up. I mean, all he was doing was looking at it.
Joyce Carol Oates wrote a very positive review of this novel in the New York Review of Books. But she says, no contemporary writer has so fetishized femaleness, as Salman Rushdie, with unflagging zeal, idealism, and irony in fiction after fiction.
Yeah, I'm not sure what you meant by that exactly. I mean, what I think is that for me, I mean, I grew up in a very female world. You know, I mean, I had three sisters and no brothers. In my larger family, the women outnumbered the men by 3-1, something like that. And so I've always been drawn towards the female characters in my books in a way more than the male characters. I think they've always been near the center. They've always been people who are lively and driving and dynamic rather than passive. And I'm very proud of the female characters in my books. And in this one, they're very near. I mean, the woman, the enchantress, in a time when women had very little power, you know, when the possibilities for women were very limited, she, nevertheless, it's her choices that drive the book and make it happen.
Jodha, Akbar's greatest love and favorite wife, is a figment of his imagination.
Yeah, and that's a kind of joke of mine, because the problem with Jodha, who today in India, everybody, if you ask people, who do you think was the queen of the Emperor Akbar, they will say Jodha. You know, it's very well known, except that she doesn't exist. She's not in the historical record at all.
So how did that happen?
It's some kind of legend that grew up. You know, it's a happy legend. It's a legend about a tolerant Muslim king who marries for love a Hindu princess and doesn't make her convert and indeed joins her in her religious observations and so on, and they live happily ever after. So it's a good myth, but it's a myth. And I thought, you know, how strange it is that this woman never existed, but everybody thinks she does. And I thought maybe 400 years ago she never existed, but everybody thought she did. And that gave me the idea of allowing him to have this Pygmalion-like, you know, semi-godlike ability to bring people into existence by the sheer force of his need for them.
People have joked that they can't figure out how you find the time to write long, complex, language-rich books like this when there's so many other commitments to deal with, most recently appearing in films like Helen Hunt's Then She Found Me.
That was 2 days, Leonard.
Yeah, well, but you played an OBGYN, and perhaps Joyce Carol Oates is right that you tend to fetishize women, and if that's the case, then a gynecologist may not be the best.
Anytime you need an ultrasound, Leonard, I'm your man.
But is media coverage of your personal life distracting? Or in this case, I think you were on The View this morning,
yeah,
weren't you?
Yeah.
I mean, writers who write serious literary novels of this sort, and that's what this is, mm-hmm, normally don't get invited onto The View.
Well, I'd just call me a pioneer. I mean, look, I think there's good and bad about it. You know, the good is that it allows me to go to places where, as you say, literature is not often discussed in order to talk to a very large audience about good books. You know, and I see that as a benefit. If you like.
Well, Oprah has opened up that world to a large, yeah, audience, but The View has not. Until today.
Until today, you see. So now I have changed The View.
Uh-huh. And you'll be touring?
Yeah, I'm just starting. I mean, this is the beginning. And for the next 4 or 5 weeks, I'll be running around the country.
Are you already thinking about the next book?
I am, but I think it's kind of at the moment on the back burner. I don't quite know what I think about it. And at the moment, I'm so focused on this one that I think I just have to leave that to bubble on the back for a while.
Because you've written a number of contemporary novels, and then now here you have a historical book again. And this is a lot sweeter than some of the previous books, which could be called rather angry at times. I was wondering about that. Do you go back and forth?
I think it's not a linear thing. You know, it depends on the thing you come up with. You know, this I do feel in this book. I felt it writing it, and I hope it communicates to the reader that there's a kind of joy in it. You know, I think there's a
joy in language as well.
Yes, and a kind of I was always very struck by the view of Italo Calvino, the great Italian writer, that the greatest literary virtues were what he called lightness, quickness, visibility, multiplicity, these things. And I thought I wanted to write a book, if I could, which had those virtues, which was light without being superficial, which moved swiftly rather than ponderously, and which made pictures in your head, of a world that you didn't know. That's what I wanted to do. And I felt happy writing the book and often excited. And I hope those qualities come across.
Well, it's the early favorite for the next Booker.
Yeah, you don't want to be the favorite, though.
The favorite never wins?
One of the laws of the Booker is the favorite never wins.
Well, maybe you'll break that rule as well. Salman Rushdie's latest novel is The Enchantress of Florence, published by Random House. Thank you so much for coming by again.
Thanks a lot. Lovely to be here.